much so heavily represented in the working class, right? And one of the reasons that we think that it's so important to mobilize to try to deny a platform for these types of ideas to be expounded upon and propagated out to the general public is, well, for one reason, workers who are afraid of a very racially hostile environment, they're a lot more difficult to organize. I know one of the other IWW locals in the U.S. right now, as soon as Trump got elected, one of their organizing committees who they had been working on a campaign to get a workplace organized, one of the main people on the committee who was a gentleman from Mexico, had to drop out of organizing because he was too scared of the potential repercussions that he would face under the Trump regime. So on that fact alone, you know, organizing against hate speech is very much a part of the program of organizing the working class. And then if you want to take a, if you, on the same note, if you want to look through a historical lens of how fascism has impacted the working class, you can look at the Weimar Republic, you know, in the buildup to Nazi Germany. The Weimar Republic, the Nazis were able to utilize a lot of populist pro-worker policies to engage their working class into supporting a very, very terrible fascist model. And if we can organize against those level of like fascist ideas as they start to reemerge in our society, then that can help us prevent the working class from being subsumed into fascist ideology and mobilized along those lines. It's about providing an alternative, right? If there's nobody who is speaking from the general left up on behalf of the working class, then it's a lot easier for people like Trump, who have a lot of populist policies, such as his opposition to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. You know, if he's the only one who's speaking up for workers against these kind of those types of policies, then workers are going to flock to that. So it's about providing an alternative to that level of dialogue as well.
So speaking of the general left, there is, I think, some widespread generalized confusion about what ought to be allowed. And I think as of late, there is this discussion specifically from like high profile liberal institutions that are in place supposedly to protect civil liberties, like the ACLU. They issued a statement last week on NPR. It was like one of the senior legal advisors, I think, on the East Coast, said that like hate speech, even though it is deplorable, even though these views aren't at all in line with what the ACLU puts forward and defends, is like an important First Amendment protection. And it hurts really badly to see people being swayed by that and like kind of buying into that idea. So can you kind of respond to that idea, and what either like legally or morally the IWW sees as problematic about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the big debate around this topic, right? Free speech, you know, the people who founded this country definitely placed a very high priority on what they felt was free speech. But I think to begin with this discussion, it's important to know what exactly free speech is, which is it's the law that has codified in that stating that the government cannot prevent people, citizens, from engaging in certain types of speech. Free speech doesn't mean that you have freedom from consequence for the terrible things you're saying from individuals or communities who very well may mobilize themselves against you. And free speech also, as an ideology, free speech assumes a certain level of equality between everybody who is, you know, supposed to be engaging in this free speech. But we live in a very inequitable society. We live in a society where there are so many different ways that people can find themselves oppressed, whether it is along class lines with the working class or racial lines with people of color who witness a high level of both institutional and personal racism and oppression. The idea that free speech is just this blank slate where anybody can come and say what they want totally ignores that level of institutional oppression that many different people face in our society. And that's one of the reasons that we find it kind of almost gross in that sense, in that it it really is ignoring an entire underlying social context that is there. When it comes to Milo himself and free speech, I don't think free speech is something that Milo himself really even cares about. I mean, of course, that's how he defends himself. But when you look at Milo's personal history when it comes to free speech, he was part of that entire Gamergate situation, which for anybody who's not familiar with that, you know, certain feminists from within the video game industry spoke up about how the terrible levels of misogyny that they were experiencing within the industry, and it turned into an entire campaign against these feminist scholars and speakers and bloggers and so on. And Milo was a big personality in propagating this war against these feminists who he claims feminists are destroying feminism. It's bizarre, really. But I mean, these women who had spoken up against the misogyny, they faced a level of attacks from Milo and his supporters that went so far as to even drive some of them in out of their homes and to change their identities because of the level of harassment they were facing. And all they were doing was engaging in their own version of speech. Those feminists were saying, hey, there's something seriously wrong with the video game industry. And because of that, Milo and his followers attacked them to the point where it severely impacted their lives. So I don't think Milo actually cares about free speech. I think that's something that he just tries to couch his bigotry in so that he can have a certain level of enjoy a certain level of defense from both institutions such as University of Washington, as well as people like Bill Maher, who just had him on his show this past Friday.
Right. I actually haven't seen that, and I don't know if I will. I don't know if I could stand that.
if you watch it, just watch it for Larry Wiltmore really shutting down Milo, because that was the only highlight of an otherwise very dismal thing.
Okay. I'll watch the highlight reel. one of my colleagues was able to get an interview with media secretary or lead PR person from UW who spoke on the university's behalf and their decision, their defense really of the decision to allow Milo to speak on campus. And they essentially said something very similar to what a lot of apologists and defenders, so-called defenders of the First Amendment are saying. What kind of institution of higher learning would we be if we didn't let right-wing student organizations bring whoever they want to campus? To which my colleague asked, so what if, you know, they invited the Grand Wizard of the KKK? And they didn't really have much to say in response to that, even though it is like a really kind of baity question and an extreme example. But given that the president of University of Washington had a sibling that was murdered by white supremacists, I believe, in North Carolina themselves. Mm-hmm. What is your / the IWW's reaction to that? And what ought to be the obligation of institutions like the University of Washington in potentially being able to mitigate a lot of, or maybe even just restrict the amount of publicity and audience that people like Milo Yiannopoulos are able to reach in these campus speaking tours, which I know are like money machines for them?
Yep. Yeah, I mean, it's a tricky situation. You know, I certainly don't envy the president of UW. You know, as you noted, her brother was murdered by the KKK at the Greensboro Massacre back in, I believe it was the 70s. So she has her own, you know, history with dealing with this much more severely than many of us will hopefully ever face. But when it comes to the institutional response, yeah, we are, as a, you know, as the Seattle IWW, are approaching it with, one, definitely a high level of frustration, but more importantly, two, not a whole lot of surprise, right? We recognize that in a country that was built upon and founded upon white supremacy and capitalism, that there, when it comes to legally recognized institutions such as UW, we're not going to find a lot of protection from them. And while we would, you know, while it would be great if they could offer that, we also don't really find ourselves too compelled to continue petitioning them for more protections. There's plenty of student groups and faculty members on campus right now who are doing that, and that's just not where we would like to focus our energies as the IWW. What we would like to focus our energies on is developing our own methods and our own organizing projects that, instead of these institutions, you know, expecting them to protect ourselves and the campus community, we would like to find ways that we ourselves can do that. Our member who was shot on January 20th, one of the very first things he said as he was coming out of his first surgery was that he has no interest at all in cooperating with the state, that he would prefer to engage in a restorative justice process with the person who shot him, which we have, you know, we found one pretty amazing that somebody, as they're just barely starting to recover from being shot, that's the first thing that comes to mind for them. But one of the reasons that he feels drawn towards that is that it takes the power away from, you know, UW Police Department. It takes power away from the UW administration, who, to begin with, had no interest in really taking proactive steps to protect us or the rest.
Okay.
Level of attacks from Milo and his supporters that went so far as to even drive some of them in out of their homes and to change their identities because of the level of harassment they were facing. And all they were doing was engaging in their own version of speech. Those feminists were saying, hey, there's something seriously wrong with the video game industry. And because of that, Milo and his followers attacked them to the point where it severely impacted their lives. So I don't think Milo actually cares about free speech. I think that's something that he just tries to couch his bigotry in so that he can have a certain level of enjoy a certain level of defense from both institutions such as University of Washington, as well as people like Bill Maher, who just had him on his show this past Friday.
Right. I actually haven't seen that, and I don't know if I will. I don't know if I could stand that.
if you watch it, just watch it for Larry Wiltmore really shutting down Milo, because that was the only highlight of an otherwise very dismal thing.
Okay. I'll watch the highlight reel. So one of my colleagues was able to get an interview with the media secretary or lead PR person from UW who spoke on the university's behalf and their decision, their defense really of the decision to allow Milo to speak on campus. And they essentially said something very similar to what a lot of apologists and defenders, so-called defenders of the First Amendment are saying.
Allotment of the overall value of our labor. So that's probably one of the biggest challenges. For those who are familiar with the history of the IWW, one thing that I constantly am running into as we're doing outreach and trying to bring people aboard is, well, what is it that the IWW does now? And I think that varies from branch to branch. You know, we have some very large branches in the U.S. and beyond. We also have a lot of really small ones. We have some cities where branches will pop up every 5 to 10 years, and they'll work on a campaign for a little while, then they'll kind of dissipate as they lose activity. So the types of work that the IWW really does vary from branch to branch, but ultimately it does all come down back to our primary goal, which is the abolition of the wage system. And there's a variety of ways to work towards that, right? You know, we're in a constant state of, as individuals, working on organizing our workplaces. And a lot of times, that doesn't look like a big, very public campaign. A lot of times organizing your workplace is as simple as going out after your shift is over with your coworkers for a beer and discussing some of the issues that you're facing in the workplace. Organizing takes on a wide range of different forms. And I think that gets kind of lost, especially when all they think of when they hear of a labor movement is they think of big, giant unions that are just these big bureaucratic messes in of themselves, where they have very little democratic input into the unions. And that's one of the real benefits of the IWW from my perspective, is that, you know, as I said, every local is a little different. So what you get out of the IWW is pretty much what you're willing to put into it. You know, you go into your branch, you get plugged into the work there. And if you have an idea for an organizing campaign within your workplace, then you bring that to the table, and there's funds available within your local as part of the dues that you as a member and your fellow workers pay. And those funds can be allocated democratically towards the campaigns that you come up with. So that was one of the big selling points for me when I was looking into whether or not I wanted to plug into the IWW. There's a lot of other projects that IWW's been working on as well, including the Incarcerated Workers Organizing Committee, or IWOC. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the massive, really historical prison strike that happened across North America over this past, towards the end of last summer. That was largely in part organized by Wobblies through the IWOC, who had been making, many of them were formerly incarcerated persons themselves, and they, you know, we recognize that our prisoners are used as a disposable labor force, and that they too deserve and need to be organized in order to better advocate for themselves and their conditions.
Cool. Thank you so much.
Absolutely. No, I really appreciate you getting in touch with us.
That was KBOO's Kanan Schlesinger speaking with a spokesperson for the Industrial Workers of the World in Seattle.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of Dance and Resist. Raise That Fist, a live broadcast dance party on February 25th at 8 p.m. at Open Signal, Portland Community Media Center. Dance and Resist, Raise That Fist will be a part of the Open Signal Open House event and will be the first broadcast of the new dance party television show featuring Kelly Danger of KBOO's Midnight Highway. This will be a space that is safe to dance for issues that we care about, self-care, and radical social change. Costumes are encouraged. Again, that's Dance and Resist, Raise That Fist, a live broadcast dance party on February 25th at 8 p.m. at Open Signal Portland Community Media Center, 2766 Northeast Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part